Okay, so where did we leave off? We finished with coracobrachialis, correct? That was our last muscle. Sorry, from pec major. Okay, great. All right. So if we continue on, even though I got that question wrong, everybody understands that that horizontal adduction or abduction, depending on the fibers, at 90 degrees, right? Because you're getting parallel to the fibers themselves, and hence the reason why you do it. Now, the muscle test for... Everybody brought their books this time, by the way? No, you didn't, did ya? I did. I reminded you last week. I remembered them. So the muscle test for coracobrachialis is actually resisted adduction, right? So you stabilize the patient, 90 degrees of abduction of the shoulder, and you resist adduction. That's the muscle test. Where are you guys in the lab as compared to us in theory? Not theory, sorry, consolidation, my apologies. In lab, where are you guys in? Are you a bit ahead, a bit behind? Okay, so what we're doing today? Okay, all right, so we're going to be doing rotator cuff and forearm bones today. Okay, all right, so pectoralis major. So medial one half of the clavicle and the aponeurosis of the external oblique, sternum, and costal cartilages of ribs 1-7. So it covers a relatively large expanse in the anterior chest wall and goes all the way down to that external oblique, which is a lot farther than you may have realized. Now, it runs out to the lateral lip of the bicipital groove. So what's it just done? By coming out to that lateral lip, so if you think of the bicipital groove here, it comes all the way across the humerus to attach on that lip. Right off the top, it must be a what? The fact that it's crossing, so here's your clue, here's the axis I'm talking about, and it crosses the joint and said axis to go to the lateral lip of the bicipital groove, so therefore it is a adductor, but in the anatomical position. Let's talk with the, in this position, it is a internal rotator. So because it crosses over anteriorly onto the lateral lip, it's an internal rotator of the GH joint. Right? So the joint crosses the GH joint anteriorly from medial trunk to lateral humerus, which also results in adduction of the arm at the joint. So it is an adductor because of that. And because it wraps around the humerus to get to the lateral lip, it's an internal or medial rotator, which again is its primary action. So adduction is primary action, internal rotation is primary action. Now the clavicular head of the muscle crosses the GH joint anteriorly with somewhat vertical fibers because of the upper parts, but only to the anatomical position, or sorry, so it results in flexion of the arm at the GH joint. So the clavicular head, right, is somewhat vertical, so therefore you get some flexion, but only so far. With the arm in, so the arm in a position of flexion, pec major can extend the arm at the GH joint, but only back to here. So we've got internal rotation, adduction, flexion, and in that slight flex position, it can bring the arm just back to here, okay, just to the anatomical position. With the arm at 100 degrees of abduction or more, the clavicular head becomes an abductor at the GH joint. Okay? Think about that. So if we take this, we're talking about the muscle coming here, right? It is at this position, less than 100 degrees, it's an adductor. But above 100 degrees, if you just watch where my fingers are in the fibers, above 100 degrees, it's a abductor. Can you see that? So down here it's an adductor, and once it gets above 100 degrees, it's now an abductor because of the fibers. Okay, see that? Adductor here, abductor there. Right? Okay. If the arm is at 100 degrees, the pec major becomes a powerful, also horizontal adductor at the GH joint. So right off the top, we have to ask ourselves, it must be that horizontal adduction is a powerful functional movement for a human being. There's a lot of muscles that are involved in horizontal adduction. So from a functional point of view, it must be very important for us because we have a lot of major muscles that do it, with pec major being the major one. Protracts the scapula when fixed to the humerus at the sternoclavicular joint. So pec major is used when throwing or pushing. Retracts the scapula when fixed to the humerus at the SCC joint when pulling. So this muscle is also used in pushing or pulling. Now that's something that you have to remember. I talked about, was it last semester, about functional abilities evaluation? Did I talk a little bit about that last semester? Or you, you know, you have a patient who's come to you and you're trying to, you know, what do you guys call it when you're trying to figure out their day-to-day living or work or that kind of stuff? What are you looking at? ADLs, right? Okay. So when we look at someone in their job and they're a puller, not a pusher, then that's a whole different exercise prescription as compared to if they're a pusher, not a puller. And that's in a sort of an industrial sense where someone may be pulling, you know, large containers or pushing things at work, that starts to play a role in terms of what muscles are affected in both of those. So this muscle can do both when the humerus is fixed. It also can depress the scapula when fixed to the humerus at the joint as well, such as overhead arm pulling the humerus and scapula towards the chest. So this. Fundamentally, though, its major roles are adduction, horizontal adduction, flexion, and internal rotation. Right, and if you think about the machines you use in the gym to work pec major, think about what those do. Right, quite often it's horizontal adduction and also rotation. Right, if you really want to get powerful with a pec major, you want to add that rotationary part. So even if you're doing internal rotators, if you're so inclined, how many here do in your shoulder workouts? How many of you do internal rotation, external rotation? Everybody does the normal press and abduction. But you should do those rotators to some degree. Well, the reality is when you're doing internal rotation quite often, because you're much more powerful in internal rotation than you are in external rotation, that's because of these. Okay, because pec major gets called in quite extensively along with anterior deltoid and that kind of stuff. Innervation, medial and lateral pectoral nerves. Now, it makes sense because of the size of this muscle, how many spinal segments actually innervate this muscle. So we've got C5, C6, C7, C8, and T1. Pretty extensive. But it is a pretty extensive muscle, with 5 and 7 being major. Now, the strength test. Oh, I forgot to change the pages. I'm so sorry. I just remembered that. I have got to do that. I have to send myself a message to do that. I believe it's in your syllabus, though. I think I made the changes in your syllabus. So if you're ever looking. Where is that? What I want? It's 266 if you want to write it down. So, it's too bad you don't. If you have your book here, pull it out. If you don't, too bad for you. So sad. Because Kendall does talk about how you can isolate the various fibers. So, when we're looking at pectoralis major, you can determine the different fibers. So, for example, there is a test for the clavicular portion of the muscle. There is also a test for the sternocostal portion of the muscle. So, you can separate this muscle to some degree in the movements. And what that has to do with, if I were to explain the clavicular portion, the action is, so the pressure is against the proximal medial forearm in the direction of abduction. The setup is the elbow is extended with the shoulder in 90 degrees flexion and a slight internal rotation. The upper extremity is abducted towards the sorry, adducted towards the sternal end of the clavicle. So you're sort of in this position, and then the pressure is against the proximal medial forearm in the direction of abduction. So that's for the clavicular portion. In the sternocostal portion, which represents the rest of the fibers of the muscle itself, the elbow is extended with the shoulder in flexion and slight internal rotation, adduction of the shoulder and upper extremity obliquely towards the opposite iliac crest. So in the clavicula, you're up here, you're resisting this. In the sternal portions, you're resisting down this way towards the iliac crest, which is going to get those lower fibers. Please start bringing your book with you. Do you take it to lab? Yeah? Do you go through this in lab? Okay, so it's a good idea to review it, make sure you do. A lot of times students say they don't use this book, like, Brian, what do we have to buy this book for? Well, it actually is your saving grace for muscle testing. And again, from a clinical perspective, when you get into clinic, it's going to make a whole lot more sense to you when you actually start testing people's strength and length, right? Because the opposite of that, of course, would be how tight is that muscle. So I'm measuring how long it is. If it's tight, is it allowing for a normal range of motion of the shoulder, or is it so tight that it's limiting range of motion of the shoulder, right? Okay. We did remember we did minor last week where that was just literally the shoulder is up and you're pushing towards the table. PNF. So this is one of those muscles, again, you can work with. Again, because it's tight. And are you guys using the PNF book much? Well, not, yeah, the pictures for setup, right? So you get the idea for setup. And it's really no different than the muscle testing in terms of whether it's this movement, depending on which head you want as far as that goes, right? Okay, so you get that setup where you're in that position where you can work both ways, depending on whether you want resistance or stretch, depending on which method you're using, okay? So we can see it here. It does have this little wrap around here that comes into that lateral lip of the bicipital groove, hence the reason for the rotation. You can see it's fairly extensive, and you can understand why the external oblique kind of has that fascial attachment here at the costal margin, which you get some sharing here. And here you can see where they've divided it out. You can see your clavicular head here in whatever color that is. And then your purple is your sternal head, and you can see the two. And you can understand that in that abduction, right, when it gets above 100 degrees, you can see how that clavicular head is now reaching up at 100 degrees, which is going to continue abduction, right? The stretch is a bit different. You can do the clavicular and sternal costal heads differently. So that is all about arm position. So whether the elbow's down in the doorframe or whether it's at 90 degrees. So now you have three pec stretches. This is clavicular head, sternal head, and pec minor. So all three can be done at the door frame. Down here, clavicular head through the door frame, 90 degrees is the sternocostal portion, and then pec minor is getting up into the door frame and stretching back like this. So all three of those pecs can be done in the door frame as a door frame stretch. Obviously, there are various exercises one can do, and depending on what you're after, bench press is the least, although it's the most popular. Everybody goes to the bench press to do pecs, the pecs. But now that you understand its responsible movements, you can isolate even that much more through internal rotation and horizontal adduction, and you tend to isolate that muscle a bit more and work it a bit more as far as that goes. Okay? Trigger points can produce symptoms that are nearly identical to pain associated with having a heart attack or angina pectoris, especially if obviously it's the left pec. So you will get that full chest pain. Referred pain from these trigger points is experienced in the chest, front of the shoulder, down the inside of the arm, along the inside of the elbow. In females, especially, it can produce tenderness in the breast and actual nipple hypersensitivity or pain in the nipple areolar area as well. Okay. Latissimus dorsi. Spinous processes of T7 to L5, posterior sacrum and posterior iliac crest via the thoracolumbar fascia. So along with the erectors, this muscle actually shares the thoracolumbar fascia with the erectors, So it's way down at the bottom. And then, of course, it's we find attachment on the three lowest ribs and the inferior angle of the scapula to the medial lip of the bicipital groove. So pectoralis minor or major finds attachment on the lateral lip of the groove, and latissimus dorsi finds attachment on the medial lip of the groove. But guess what? It's also an internal rotator. Now, pec major has to wrap around and come anteriorly to the GH joint. So it's coming from anterior kind of to posterior. Yes, everybody follows that in your mind? Whereas latissimus dorsi comes up from the bottom behind, comes posteriorly, and does this little loop-de-loop, little turn to come into that medial lip of the intertrabecular groove. So therefore, it's an internal rotator. Why? Because it's crossing the joint from posteriorly. So pec major is an internal rotator because it's going from anterior to posterior, and latissimus dorsi is a medial rotator because it's coming from posterior to anterior. Does that make sense to everybody? Yes? Okay. So this muscle crosses the GH joint from medial on the pelvis to lateral on the humerus by wrapping around the anterior surface to reach the medial lip of the bicipital groove, which results in medial rotation of the arm at the GH joint. So you have to remember, it does this little twist to grab onto that medial lip. It also crosses the GH joint posteriorly and results in adduction of the arm at the GH joint and extends the arm. So it can adduct, and because it's reaching from behind forward, it's an extender. Everybody follow me so far? Remember when I did that, you know, you guys all couldn't understand when I did the circle with the dumb muscle lecture, and it's how it crosses the axis, right? Now it's starting to make sense, isn't it? You've got to understand where that muscle crosses and where it comes from, hence the reason why it works. Again, muscles are dumb, they just contract, but it's where they are in relationship to the axes of the joints that it's related to that causes all the actions that we talk about. That makes more sense now when I say that than when I said it in the first semester. It also depresses the scapula, the sternocostal joint. Now, this muscle has a reverse action. So if the arm is in an elevated position above the trunk, and the humeral attachment is fixed, this muscle pulls the trunk superiorly towards the humerus and will cause the anterior trunk to face the contralateral side of the body. So it does this. You know, Martin Short, you know. Nobody knows that character anymore. You're all too young, right? Ed Grimley? Do you guys remember Ed Grimley? No, that was Martin Short's very first character before he became super popular. So because you're here, unilaterally, it will do this. Make sense? Yeah.
Can you just explain in general
the Okay, so when we looked at the attachments as being this lower component, thoracolumbar fascia and so on and so forth, right? So it's the arm is moving, so no problem. It's causing all these actions to occur. But if I fix the arms, so I'm on a bar and they can't move, and the muscle contracts, the reverse action is this. What's the other reverse action that's not on there? I'm in the right position. I'm on a bar. What am I doing? Pulling my body up towards the bar. So therefore, this is fixed, and I'm doing the opposite movement here. Right. So when my arms are like this unilaterally, they're fixed. So therefore, the only movement is my trunk because of its attachment. So it's doing the contralateral rotation because the arm can't rotate because it's fixed on the bar. When I say reverse action, what I'm saying is that the traditional action of a muscle, you think of your two attachments, right? You've got your proximal and your distal attachments. So what we're saying in the first part of this is that the lower part is fixed, right? So where the thoracolumbar fascia is and so forth. So therefore, it affects change of movement in the arm where it attaches at the medial lip of the bicipital groove. If I lock said arm, then the actions are this part does some kind of movement, whatever it is. Make sense, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Innervation, thoracodorsal nerve, C6, C7, and C8. Now, the strength test here I can find it quickly. It is on page 272. It's an it's a bit of an interesting just come on up. Okay, we'll just do it standing. So what happens is you've got the patient in prone. So we're gonna pretend that Nick's lying on the table, you know, the table's here as far as that goes, and I'm over top. All right, so it's shoulder adduction with extension. All right, so the pressure is against the distal forearm in the direction of shoulder abduction and flexion. So he's going to be in this position, and I'm going to stabilize, and I'm going to go into shoulder abduction and flexion. So you're going to resist me. So that's the movement. All right, you can feel it in here? Yeah. All right, so it's the exact opposite. Thank you. So you can see it's a very large muscle, and you can see the little twist here as it comes into this medial lip of the bicipital groove. So now you have pectoralis major on the lateral lip of the groove, and you have latissimus dorsi on the medial lip of the groove. And both are internal rotators simply because of their orientation to the axis for rotation. One coming from the back, lats, one coming anteriorly, pectoralis major. Stretching, any of these sort of, what do you call that in yoga? What is that in yoga? Downward dog will stretch latissimus dorsi because of the position you're in bilaterally. And then, of course, is there a name for this in yoga? I don't know. It's just that side reach. Yeah, that side reach will do it unilaterally as far as that goes. There are a number of different exercises that you can do for this. It usually tends to get included in back routines. So you can do wide grip pull downs. You can do wide grip pull-ups. You have to be kind of strong to do that, unless you've got one of those, you know, those new resistance bands that you can put around your knee that kind of helps you. Or you can get in that machine that's got the little platform that you can kneel in. Okay, so a guy like me who's like weak like stick, I have to use that. I can't pull my own weight with a wide grip pull-up. Can anybody in here do that? Do a complete all the way up? Yeah, I can't do it. Never been able to do it. Back in the fitness test all the time, I always lost upper body strength. I have skinny arms. But man, I can run fast. Okay, so wide grip. They also do get included because of that extension component. They also get used in seated row, right? Where as you're reaching forward in that flexion position, when you come through, you are working with lats as you're coming back and pulling your those arms into extension, right? Okay? All right. Trigger points. They can produce a constant ache at rest and difficulty sleeping on the side where the trigger point is. Can cause joint dysfunction of the vertebra to which it's attached. Posterior trigger points cause pain locally deep with referral across the posterior scapula that we can see here. And we can also get referred pain down to the medial arm to the fourth and fifth digits on the palmar surface here. Anterior trigger point refers to apex of the shoulder. Now, can you get into lats anteriorly? Oh, yes, you can, right? That, you know, so if you want to make that muscle a bit flaccid, it would be adduction and internal rotation, right, that will get you in behind latissimus dorsi. This is a muscle very similar to pec major. You'd want it loose to get in and grab it. Right, and you can get a lot of trigger points in here as far as that goes as well. But again, getting that muscle loose in with adduction internal rotation will help. Okay, teres major. We're just about into the rotator cuff, but not quite yet. So teres major arises from the inferior angle and inferior one-third of the lateral border on the dorsal surface of the scapula. Okay, we're saying here. Inferior angle, inferior one-third of the lateral border, okay, the lateral border on the dorsal surface of the scapula. So that little square right there, that little border right there is teres major. So this is infraspinatus, this is teres major, that is supraspinatus, and that is subscapularis. So you might want to draw like this on your own scapula. So it's right here. It's this little square right there. Right there it attaches. Okay. Right there. Right here. Yay! Good. Okay. You're here. Didn't take quite as long this time. No, no kidding. Okay. All right. So, inferior angle, inferior one-third, lateral border, dorsal surface of the scap to the medial lip of the bicipital groove of the humerus. We now have two muscles on the medial lip of the bicipital groove. Teres major and latissimus dorsi. Okay. Now, this muscle also comes from posterior to anterior, so therefore it must be a internal rotator. Right. Okay. You get the idea? See how much easier it makes the anatomy if you just figure out where it comes from, where it goes, and it really helps with understanding the actions. So the muscle crosses the GH joint from medial on the scapula to lateral on the humerus, wrapping around the anterior surface to attach on the medial lip of the bicipital groove, which then, of course, is going to result into its major action, which is internal rotation, simply because it comes up and attaches, right? Comes up around and attaches. Because of this, the medial scapula, this medial scapula to anterior humerus, we also get adduction. Again, because it's coming around from behind and coming up, it's a rotator, but it's also an adductor because of the way that it's coming up. The fibers run somewhat vertical in the sagittal plane, therefore it does help extend the arm. Does that make sense? Again, because it's back here and it's reaching up almost vertically, it's going to cause extension of the arm as well. Okay. Reverse motor action, when the humerus is fixed and not moving, it actually rotates the scapula at the GH joint and the sternocostal joint with upward rotation in some of the fibers and then downward rotation because of the anterior humeral attachment of the scapula when the humerus is fixed. So depending on the fibers, you can get either or. You can either get upward rotation or downward rotation. Remembering that this rotation is all about taking the glenoid fossa and making sure that its orientation is correct to the humeral head when we're into abduction. Remember, you need that rotation in order to abduct. Without rotation, you don't get the full abduction that's required, okay? Innervation, lower scapular nerve, C5, C6, C7. Now, teres major is a little bit different. Again, can I use you, Nick? Okay, so we're going to face them this time. Again, we're going to pretend that Nick is lying on the table, okay? So he's facing onto the table, and the position we're going to put him into is here. This is called, we call that lower apples. So in other words, what we're saying is, teres major is the test. You have extension and adduction of the shoulder in the internally rotated position with the hand resting on the ipsilateral posterior iliac crest. So sitting here as far as that goes, right? Setting up that way. And then the pressure is against the arm, proximal to the elbow, in the direction of shoulder abduction and flexion. So, proximal to the elbow, shoulder abduction and flexion. So, I'm going to stabilize you pretending you're on the table. So, I'm going to push and, flexion and outwards. Okay, you ready? So, you're going to resist. And good. All right. So, again, you have to think of the actions. So, flexion, don't resist this time. Flexion and abduction at the same time. When you have to do two movements at the same time, you always want to get a good grip around so that that hand can go both directions at the same time. He did exactly what a normal patient does. He gets a little confused which one I'm asking him to resist. That's quite normal for patients. So you explain you want both at the same time. And again, it's not 100% strength, right? No, count of five, hold for five, right? Same as you always do with muscle testing. Okay, thanks. So we can see here, it kind of, kind of tucks up underneath here, teres major is here, and you can see that inferior angle of the scapula. And again, it does that little wraparound thing to get to that medial lip of the bicipital groove anteriorly on the humerus. stretch, of course, then if it's an internal rotator and extender, the stretch then would be external rotation and flexion. That's a nice stretch for it, okay? We can see here it also gets involved in the seated row position, and of course, along with deltoid and pectoralis major, internal resistant internal rotation will use it. So now you have pectoralis major, anterior deltoid, and teres major are all internal rotators. That might be the way you want to kind of study it. You know, maybe do a chart to say, what are all the internal rotators? What are all the external rotators? And so forth, and break it down that way. That might make it easier for some of you as far as that goes. Trigger points here, pain in the posterior shoulder, usually restriction and abduction, and you can possibly get wing scapula. Often these are incorrectly assessed as GH joint dysfunction, AC dysfunction, or deltoid strain, or rotator cuff dysfunction. How many of you found trigger points in this muscle when you were practicing in lab? This muscle can have lots of trigger points. Did you palpate this muscle in lab? Did some of you find it kind of ropey and stringy? It's not as bad as infraspinatus, but it will have its fair set of trigger points. Well, just palpating, you might find it. Some of them might be so tender that even just palpating, you might find some trigger points. Okay, so now we get into the infamous rotator cuff. Why is it called a rotator cuff? Did it look like what? Yeah, so you can see it right here. See how it goes all the way around? So you have all this tendinous material of these muscles, and they create a cuff around the GH joint. So the rotator cuff is the tendons of supraspinatus, infraspinatus, teres minor, and subscapularis. And what they do, they all join together to form a cuff across both the greater and lesser tubercles. And you can see it here. So all the way across here, your greater and lesser tubercle, we have this rotator cuff here, subscapularis, it runs all the way around. Now what's interesting is, long head biceps does split a little bit and run through here as it goes into its supraglenoid tubercle. At the top, we haven't got there yet, but we will get to that muscle momentarily today. But you can see how this cuffs all the way around. When artists do the rendition, they make it all look like it's all, you can divide them. The reality is, anatomically, you do have parts of tendinous material, shall we say, that fills in the blanks. And you can kind of see it here. So when we look at the actual tendons of the muscles, we can see how they fit like that. So picture that there's tendinous material kind of filling in the spaces between each of the individual tendons to create this entire cuff that's happening, okay? These act to fix the head of the humerus and the glenoid cavity, especially when abducting. Because the shoulder has given up stability for mobility, these are the muscles that play a vital role in normal function of the GH joint. And of course, we've got a whole bunch of bursa in here because we've got all these muscles that are crossing over. So we have all these minor bursas that come over top. Have you guys done this in lab? It's the easiest way to remember. So grab your partner. Have you found the greater and lesser tubercles? Okay. So grab a partner. Have them turn their back to you. And do you remember last week I showed you how you just lay your hand on top of the acromion and you can drop down in? So I want you to, again, palpate and find the greater and lesser tubercle like you normally would, however that's going to be. And then what you're going to do is your thumb. Now, what position does the shoulder have to be in to palpate the lesser tubercle? Has to be externally rotated, right? So in the normal anatomical position, you cannot palpate the lesser tubercle because it's rotated in deep. So you must externally rotate to find the lesser tubercle. The thumb sits on the lesser tubercle, right? So that is subscapularis. And then the next three fingers, the index finger is on the greater tubercle and the next two behind the index finger. The index finger represents supraspinatus. The middle finger represents infraspinatus, and the third finger represents teres minor. Kind of hard to a puffy coat, isn't it? Does everybody understand that?
No.
take your hoodie off. If you've got a shirt on underneath, and come on, you come bring your seat around. Okay. Tally's gonna show us here. So gonna roll up here. So I'm gonna keep Tally seated just because it's easier for me. So either or, it doesn't matter. So we've got our humerus here, and our glenohumeral joint. So I'm just going to ask her just externally and internally rotate back and forth, and I can feel the bicipital groove there. Okay, so I can kind of feel it. So stay out. Okay, so there's the lesser tubercle. So the lesser tubercle is subscapularis. There's the bicipital groove. So my finger comes just lateral to it. So there is what muscle? Supraspinatus. Next is my next finger, infraspinatus, and then teres minor. So my thumb represents subscapularis on the lesser tubercle. My index finger represents supraspinatus, right? Supraspinatus on the greater tubercle. Then what's behind that? Infraspinatus on the next finger, and then subscapularis right after that. That's the greatest and easiest way to orient your rotator cuff. Thumb was on the lesser for subscap. Then find the groove, and you want to go lateral to the groove. Supraspinatus, infraspinatus, teres minor. It's like playing piano. Okay, now you can go short. I can tell you from experience, more often than not, therapists get this wrong in terms of positioning. Okay, everybody kind of feels it now, get a sense of where you are. Now, if you can picture this, I've had both my shoulders done. Both my shoulders, my supraspinatus tendon was torn right off the greater tubercle. In both cases, both shoulders. One was during I was shoveling a driveway, and I did an aggressive, I was out living up in Wasega Beach, or at the Washego at the time, and I had these big mounds of snow, and I took this real aggressive shove with the shovel, and I didn't realize it was a big hunk of ice under there, and it stopped, and I kept going. So, and then this one, I don't know why this one went, but it just went, I think, just working out all the time. So what they had to do was their supraspinatus, it was completely off. They grab the muscle, they pull it over the greater tubercle, and they take a plastic screw and a Black & Decker screw head, and they go, and they screw the tendon in. After they've scraped the bone bloody to get the blood for healing, and then they screw the tendon in, and then I was in a sling like this for 6 weeks. I couldn't move it. All I can say is, when it's your right hand, the next time you use the washroom, try using your opposite hand to, shall we say, clean yourself up afterwards. It's quite the. I once had a patient whose friend broke both their arms at the same time. So they were like this for 6 to 8 weeks. So somebody, shall we say, had to kind of take care of them. Because how are you going to take care of yourself if you can't use both arms? I guess it's called a bidet. Kind of get in there. I don't know. So everybody understands that? So that's the best way to orient where these muscles we're about to take are. Thumb, lesser tubercle, subscapularis, index finger, greater tubercle, supraspinatus behind that, infraspinatus behind that. Right? Everybody got it? Okay. So teres minor. So that's the way to sit it. It does sit like a cuff like this. Remember, we kind of talked a little bit about it earlier. Remember, we've got the subdeltoid semicromial bursa in here. So imagine, if you will, again, I'll get to the muscles shortly. Imagine, if you will, though, you've got a tendonitis in here. You've got inflammation because of a multitude of reasons. So, you, of course, along with that tendonitis, you get some edema, you get swelling, you get that jamming up. Have we talked about impingement a little bit? Okay, the classic supraspinatus tendonitis impingement. Okay, so we get to, how many degrees is this? 90 to about 130, they can't do it. Because what's happening is, when we get, as we're working our way up, and you think of that space in there with the supraspinatus tendon and the subacromial bursa, right, we're making that space smaller, 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 and at 90 degrees, it's so small, we've jammed Now the bursa and the supraspinatus tendon, that's already inflamed and irritated and so on and so forth, and ouch, it hurts, and the patient can't go any higher. So it's usually between about 80 to 110 degrees, they have pain. So what they literally will do is they'll get to here, and then they'll take their arm and they'll get it above 180, because now we're into scapular rotation, not jamming the humeral head, and then they can finish their abduction, because they're no longer using the humerus to finish their abduction, they're using scapular rotation to finish their abduction. Everybody follow? Okay. But this is the classic, I can't go any further. You're looking at supraspinatus tendonitis or something along that line. The other thing, again, just as a little side pocket, shoulder is one of the few joints in the body where the patient will express pain at night when they are sleeping. Okay. Any other nocturnal pain is usually a red flag for things like cancer. So if a patient says they have pain at night lying in bed, usually that's something that needs to be investigated, except for the hip joint and the shoulder joint. And I can tell you, again from experience, with someone I was with at the time, if I wanted to spoon with them and, you know, just put my arm over, kind of over their shoulder, couldn't do it for any more than about 30 seconds, and I would have to move my arm. The pain was excruciating to try to lie like this at night. When your shoulder is bad and you've got something that needs to be repaired like I did, my tossing and turning would be all night. I would have to change my sleeping position 50 times a night to constantly try to get off the pain as best I could, finding all these different ways to sleep to try to relieve the discomfort. So nocturnal pain is really common in shoulder issues. Okay, we can see here in the cadaver. Well, there's your bursas, so you get the idea of what I'm talking about. There's quite a lot of them. So here we are in the cadaver. You can see how much space there is not because the bursa has been removed. So imagine your subacromial bursas filling in that tiny, tiny little space in there. So here's your humeral head, and you can see supra-infra-anteres minor. They wrap around and form a cuff around the proximal area, right into that greater and lesser tubercle. Here's teres major, which we just talked about, and then coming here to the humerus, you can see the humerus is right here, and then longhead triceps comes up behind these to find its attachment. And we haven't done that muscle yet, but if you remember when we talked about the scapula, it attaches on the infraglenoid tubercle, or as biceps brachii, of course, attaches on the supraglenoid tubercle. But you can see how everything's kind of jammed in here, and the potential for problems is quite high. Okay? All right. So let's do the first one, subscapularis. Name tells you where it is, on the subscapular fossa. So it attaches from the subscapular fossa to the lesser tubercle of the humerus. Therefore, it is the only rotator of the rotator cuff that attaches on the lesser tubercle. Okay? It crosses the GH joint anteriorly from medial to laterally wrap around the humerus to attach on the lesser tubercle. Therefore, subscapularis is an internal rotator. It's an internal rotator. It's a reverse action. When the humerus is fixed, the muscle pulls the medial border of the scapula against the thorax, and it does so, therefore, it isometrically helps stabilize the GH joint and the scapula. So again, this is where it's so important to understand that when someone has a bad shoulder, these are the ones that have to work. Now, I meant to do something. Who can I do here? Come on up. Hey, by the way, before I ask, has anybody here got a bad shoulder? Okay, a really bad shoulder? I think we already did this before. Come on up. That's okay, I don't need you. Come on up. Especially in abduction, yes? Yes, okay. So, I'm not going to hurt you. I'm actually going to make you feel better. Wait, which one is it?
All right.
Okay, so let's do the anatomy first. So we've got a scapula and a humerus, right? And we want, and I've said this many, many times already, we want good orientation between the head of the humerus and the glenoid fossa of the scapula, correct? Okay, so we want to maintain a really good relationship there. When we have weakness due to dysfunction, remember another saying Brian says, pain inhibits function. So if someone has pain, they can't function well. Because the shoulder gave up stability for mobility and relies on musculature for stability, if there's pain and dysfunction and weakness, What happens is this, the humeral head drops down. Now, once it's dropped down, guess what's going to happen? It's going to jam really early and quickly in it. All right, so let's just have you do this normal abduction to where you feel discomfort, but don't go any further. And that's not too bad? Okay, can you go a bit further? And that there, not too bad. Now, if I do this and resist, is that when you have the discomfort?
A little bit.
A little bit. Okay, so what I'm going to demonstrate or try to demonstrate is if I take the humeral head and I become the muscle and I push the humeral head where it's supposed to be, now abduct. Just go ahead. I'm going to just keep pushing. A lot less discomfort, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So what's happened is her humeral head has dropped down because of weakness. So therefore, mechanically, her GH joint isn't functioning properly. So if I play the role of muscles and put the humeral head in the appropriate orientation to the glenoid fossa, patient feels a lot better in abduction. So that is why it's so vitally important to strengthen those rotator cuff muscles to get that humeral head back to where it belongs. Thank you. Okay? So this is where these muscles stabilize that GH joint by retaining the orientation between the humeral head and the glenoid fossa. And if someone's really bad, like with a supraspinatus tear, your humeral head's like just hanging down there. It can't be where it's supposed to be. Therefore, you get all this discomfort and these pain patterns because the orientation just isn't working. Innervation, upper and lower scapular nerves, C5, C6, with the major 6. If you start putting these all down in some kind of graph, you're going to note that when we're looking at the shoulder joint, C5, C6 are the major innervators of all these muscles. And C5, C6, mechanically at the C-spine, is kind of a problem area for human beings in terms of arthritic changes, intervertebral, foraminal stenosis, where you get disc degeneration disease and those foramina get small and irritated. So sometimes you can't help the patient too much with strengthening because they've got some kind of impingement at the C-spine at 5 and 6 that's actually affecting the strength of the muscle. So then you've got kind of an added sort of challenge, right, as far as that goes. I hope when I'm talking like this, I'm not confusing the hell out of you, am I? No? Okay. All right. In a muscle test, I do those in lab. The stretch and strengthen, internal rotation with resistance, external rotation and supine for stretch. And this is where we, you know, I'll talk a bit when we see in a moment. So, of course, subscapularis is taking up the full majority of the subscapular fossa. We can see it coming around here to that tubercle, and it is an internal rotator simply because it's coming from posterior to anterior. It is palpable, right? Did you guys do this? Did you do the sideline where you pulled the arm up in the air and then exposed the anterior surface of the scapula, right? Okay. We can see we're sort of looking through here, so the ribs have been removed, and we can see how it comes around and binds on the lesser tubercle that we can see here. This is a lovely intro rehab strengthening program. Again, if someone's relatively weak. In fact, has anybody here ever watched professional pitchers in baseball? They'll sit them down on a table and they have a device that resists both internal and external rotation. So they lock the wrist into a handle and the individual does this against resistance to help strengthen, right? This is one of the problems also with baseball. And if anybody here is so inclined to baseball, when I used to play baseball, if I was to pitch a ball, I would throw and carry through accordingly like this. We don't see that anymore. For power, what we see is pitchers in this position, and then they throw. And this is why they're all having so many problems with shoulders, because they finish like this. Well, the problem is, when I do this, right, my rotators, my tiny little rotators, I've created all this momentum and force. Newton's law, what's my arm want to do? It wants to keep going. So when I've created this, my arm wants to keep going. So these tiny little rotators go, no, you're not going anywhere. And this is why we run into problems with things like pitching, that kind of stuff. This is a lovely exercise as well for intro to it. And, of course, then internal rotation will work as well. But, yes, this is a lovely kind of intro for rehab. Trigger points. This, it can be a nasty trigger point. It can harbor up to 3 trigger points, with the 2 most common occurring near the outside edge of the muscle. So this is where, when you did that palpation in lab and you expose that lateral anterior part of the subscap, this is where you're going to find the trigger points. Luckily, the trigger point in the inside edge of the muscle is much less common because it's nearly impossible to contact by palpation and release. Referred pain from these in the subscap concentrates in the posterior shoulder region with spillover into the shoulder blade region and down the back of the arm. You can, in the cases, have a unique band of revert pain around the wrist, like a sweatband, with the pain in and around the wrist. It's one of the classic ones for it. Now, Travell, which is the individual who invented trigger points, and this is one of her diagrams, she says, because you've probably all heard a little bit of frozen shoulder now, okay, subscapular trigger points can actually be misdiagnosed as frozen shoulder. So sometimes you need to get in there and see if they're not getting anywhere with resolution of frozen shoulder, get into subscap and see if you can find trigger points in there, and I bet you'll find nasty ones. When you palpated this muscle, did anybody find trigger points just in normal palpation? No? Okay. You're going to find them, trust me. Okay, so that's the first one, lesser tubercle. Now we're getting into the greater tubercle. Supraspinatus, it arises from the medial two-thirds of the supraspinous fossa, goes under the acromion to the superior facet of the greater tubercle. So this puppy goes like this, goes over top onto it, all right? So it comes from that suprascapular fossa, and then supraspinous fossa, and then comes over top and underneath the acromion to come on top of the greater tubercle, the anterior facet of the greater tubercle. Because it crosses the GH joint over the top of the joint, it abducts the arm at the GH joint. So it is an abductor, all right? The fibers run parallel to the middle fibers of the middle deltoid and initiates and moves the arm through abduction. Now, he doesn't say this in the book, but this is what we were always taught, and even Michelle said the same thing. That because its fibers run completely parallel to middle deltoids, and we know the middle deltoids is an abductor, supraspinatus initiates abduction and deltoids middle fibers continues abduction. So we used to say that supraspinatus is the first 15 degrees of abduction, and then middle deltoid takes over. All right? He doesn't use those degrees. I don't know if it's popular in the profession anymore, but understand that supraspinatus does initiate abduction, and then middle deltoid takes over after that because it's a much more powerful abductor than supraspinatus could ever hope to be. It pulls the arm up into the plane of the scapula, which also pulls the scapula somewhat into the sagittal plane. Some calling it a sagittal frontal plane movement as scaption. So, come on up just for a second. So a test for supraspinatus. Have you guys heard the term scaption before? Okay. So what we're saying here is it pulls the arm up into the plane of the scapula, which also pulls the scapula into the sagittal plane, so bringing it sagittally this way, okay? And this is called sagittal frontal plane movement. So it's in frontal plane, right here, and it's also sagittal. So if you want to isolate supraspinatus, both for testing and strengthening, I'm going to have him come into a bit of an angle here. So I'm going to come up to the frontal plane, but then I want it to come somewhat into the sagittal plane. And we're into this sort of degree angle here. This is known as scaption. If I truly want to strengthen it or test it, I'll put him into medial rotation, and I'm going to ask him to resist. See how weak it is? Yeah, okay. So I've isolated supraspinatus in that scaption position. So just for fun, let's do this one. Over we go. And see how much stronger it is? You have a problem? You had a problem with this one before?
No.
Okay, this one's significantly weaker. Okay, but this is your dominant side too, right?
Yeah.
You play baseball, that kind of stuff, and throw?
I don't know what it is. I've thrown an object.
Okay. So that's called scaption, and it's this frontal sagittal movement that supraspinatus causes with the scapula in that position. So in scaption, I can resist, I can put a dumbbell in there to strengthen supraspinatus, and as you saw, I can also strength test it. Now, I have no idea what Kendall says for it. I should probably have a look here and see what she's got for supraspinatus. Where are we here? She just says them as a group as external rotators, so. But this is not a rotator. And now that's the other thing. So supraspinatus is part of the rotator cuff. Have you seen any rotation in its action yet? Yes.
Going back to the trigger
subscapular, because it wraps all the way around. It doesn't cause it's a great question, but it doesn't cause the paresthesia in the appropriate fingers. So classically with carpal tunnel, because it's being impinged, it affects the medial nerve, so therefore thumb, first and second and third finger, they get paresthesia. This would just be literally the patient would express, I feel tight in around my wrist. Let's convert to my hand. So we see the reverse action we can see here, and of course it too ulcerate isometrically stabilizes the GH joint. What I really want you to understand is that as much as this is considered to be in the rotator cuff, now you got to come up four more forward. So it's here. There you go. Okay. It's not a rotator. It's in the rotator cuff, but it's not a rotator. It's an abductor. Because they share all the fibers. Now, the thing is, when we looked at that shoulder that was dropped, and I talked about the glenohumeral relationship in the head of the humerus, supraspinatus is vitally important because it comes over the top for keeping the head up and in of the humerus. So if supraspinatus is weak, the head will drop out and down, and then now you have the mechanical problem of appropriate abduction, right? So this is why supraspinatus needs to be strengthened so significantly as part of the group to make sure that the shoulder functions appropriately. So we can see here, coming across the top, over here, if I go back to the initial diagram here, we can see how supraspinatus comes over and through to the top onto that greater tubercle on that anterior facet here, okay? And again, it's the reason why it's an abductor. So you can see it here. Again, there's our subdeltoid subacromial bursa here that lies between the tendon of supraspinatus and the acromion itself. We've talked a little bit about that quite a bit. The stretch is lower aplis. You guys done that assessment yet at all? So how many people here can touch their hands? So one lower or one upper? Okay. All right. Can your fingers touch? Okay, now change sides. See if it's the same. Yeah, good for you. Because of surgeries, this is my max. Yeah, I can't do it. Okay, to be able to touch fingers is appropriate range of motion for the GH joint both sides. So this stretch. So I would take, say, an exercise band or a towel, right? I put it over my shoulder, grab it, and I would pull it up with my other hand. That's stretching supraspinatus. Initiation of abduction. You can go this high if you choose to, but obviously when she's getting up here, she's into middle deltoids because supraspinatus initiates abduction. Doesn't finish it, right? Here you can see resisted scaption, which does isolate supraspinatus, again, if you want to isolate. Remember, I've told you the story before. Remember, I had the big true cop, and he was this big, huge, muscular guy, and he hurt his shoulder, and I gave him a 2.5-pound dumbbell, and he couldn't do it. I put him into scaption, and that's what it was. I tried to get him into this abduction, and he couldn't do it, and he was shocked. Guy's got deltoids the size of my head, and he can't even do a 2.5-pound dumbbell because I isolated the muscle, and it wouldn't work. Okay. Now, I'm not I'm not a big fan of shoulder abduction from a rehab perspective. Because if the humeral head is not well seated in the relationship to the glenoid fossa, you can see how when they get into this position, the humeral head will drop. Right? So how many people here when they do abduction get little crunchies? Feel like a bit of a crunchy? Stop doing them. Because what's happening is, when you're doing them, because you're not strong enough to do them, you're actually doing this. So that crunching is that humeral head falling down. Okay? Yes, you're actually crunching it. So,
how about if, like, I do this, like, I can hear my shoulder.
Yeah, so again, we have to think of levers. Remember we took levers last semester? Okay, which is harder to do? This or this? Right, because the lever is longer. Okay, now as soon as I put a weight on here, because that lever is longer, it's increasing significantly the stress on the humeral head and the glenoid fossa. So this possibly. If you really want to work your shoulder safely, go on the double cables and do T's, V's, and I's. They're by far the best. So one set is this, this, and this. You work your shoulders very, very well just doing those. Okay. Kettlebell, anteriors, right? That will, not only does it work core, but it also works shoulder as well. It takes a lot of stress off that humeral head. All right. Trigger points in supraspinatus, pain to the lateral shoulder, forearm, and wrist, radiating pain into the lateral epicondyle can lead to a misdiagnosis of tennis elbow. So a trigger point in supraspinatus could be deadness diagnosis, tennis elbow. Now, tennis elbow is extensor retinaculum. So tennis is extension of the wrist, okay? So this can be referred into this area and, and be misdiagnosis tennis elbow. All right, take a break. See you guys at 10:02. Okay, let's continue with this rotator cuff. So our next one is infraspinatus. So obviously its name tells you where it is. Supraspinatus was above the spine in the supraspinous fossa. Infraspinatus below the spine in the infraspinous fossa. So this is a very active muscle because many movements require lateral rotation at the shoulder. And because of that, this puppy gets lots of trigger points. In fact, I pretty much could touch everybody in this room and likely find trigger points. In my experience of treatment, just about every patient I've ever touched in this area has trigger points in infraspinatus. I can just do this. Watch.
Ouch.
Going up right there, right? It's going out into your arm, isn't it? Yeah. Everybody's got them. Just like that. They're that simple. They're that common. So, it attaches from the medial two-thirds of the infraspinous fossa, and this one goes to the middle facet of the greater tubercle. So remember, supraspinatus went to the anterior facet of the greater tubercle, and this is this one goes to the middle facet. Again, that of the three fingers over top that you touched, right? Subscap, supra, infra is right behind on the next facet on there. It crosses the GH joint posteriorly from medial to lateral and wraps around the humerus to the middle facet, which therefore results in the posterior side of the humerus moving medially, which is lateral rotation. So because it comes up this way, so if we think of the humerus here and the two tubercles, we had subscap come from behind and come up onto the lesser tubercle here. Infraspinatus comes up this way and wraps around this way to the middle facet, so therefore it's a lateral rotator. So where subscap is a medial rotator, because infra comes from behind here and up and on, therefore it is a lateral rotator. With the arm at 90 degrees abduction, the pull is horizontal, which results in horizontal abduction at the GH joint. So at 90 degrees, this is a muscle that horizontally abducts because of the position and the relationship when it comes up. Eccentrically stabilizes both the GH joint and the scapula. So getting the idea, again, as I've mentioned a couple of times, how integral these muscles are to stabilizing this GH joint, or this relationship between the scapula and the head of the humerus, to make sure that they're congruently related to each other appropriately, the humeral head and the glenoid fossa. Innervation is subscapular nerve, C5, C6. Muscle test, I'll have you do that. The stretch is chicken wing, and of course PNFs are just positioning. So we can see here, we had supraspinatus here, infraspinatus is here, and teres major sort of lies anterior to it with minor underneath. So if you want, you can palpate each other, just be careful. Find that lateral aspect of the scapula. Find the two bumps in the road. So start inferiorly. Your first bump, you'll go over teres minor into a groove and then up onto infraspinatus. So again, find that lateral border of the scapula. Okay, find that inferior angle and come off that lateral border. Your first bump will be teres minor, and then your next big bump will be infraspinatus. Feel it now?
Yeah.
Feel the bump, the groove, and then up onto it. And right at that groove, on that inferior border of infraspinatus, that's where the trigger points are. Right along that inferior border of infraspinatus. So you don't even have to put the arm in this position. Just bring it down here. So watch this come here. Okay, so I'm going to go into, there's a lump right there. That's,
mm-hmm.
that's teres minor. And then I come up into the next one right there. That's infraspinatus. Killer, eh? Everybody has trigger points in infraspinatus. Right along that inferior border. Right up to the front of the shoulder. Yeah. There's a scapula here, okay, and there's a board. That first one, that's, so there's, we got, let's find the spine, right? Okay, the border's here. So there's teres minor, and there's a hole right there, and then that's infraspinatus. So feel, there's teres minor, hole.
Yeah.
That right there.
Oh.
And is that referring out into the shoulder?
No.
Just sore?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's infraspinatus right there.
Okay.
Okay. Everybody's like, you're not touching me, Brian. Well, everybody has them. So again, there's your lateral border, there's teres minor, and there's infraspinatus right there. Is that referring at all or just sore? Okay, good for you. No, you're one of the few. But you can feel me roll off and on. So that's teres minor there. And then a little bit of a groove, and then I'm up onto infraspinatus. So, do you feel the groove? What's that? Okay, relax your arm. Okay, so there's the lateral border. There's teres minor. Okay, feel a bump in, and then you're up over top of something. See right there? Right there. So if you go into that groove, so teres minor, and then there's infraspinatus right there.
So you, going down my arm.
Yeah, going right down your arm, right? Okay. So, yeah, we're still right there.
Okay.
Yep. So maybe for many of you, if you push firm enough, you've got a trigger point, it might be your first trigger point you've ever come across, that when the patient says, oh my goodness, that's going down my arm, okay? So that's kind of where it is. So that's the chicken stretch right there. That's the stretch right. How do you do with it falling over? Yeah, this will stretch it. Yeah, it helps because it just pull that much more. Okay, trigger points here, as you've all found out. The muscle can contain three trigger points arranged in a triangular pattern within the belly. In my experience, this is my own quotation, the lower trigger point is the most common and most active in shoulder complaints. Referred pain from these is experienced deep to the front of the shoulder joint along the upper arm. The pain can also spill down into the forearm and hand. Quite often, the patient will say, it feels like the front of my shoulder is blowing out. That's how much they can feel the pain kind of coming to the anterior shoulder. Okay, so next one is teres minor. Obviously, teres means round and minor means small. And, of course, teres minor is smaller than teres major, right? So teres major, remember, was down here in this little inferior angle square, right? It was right here in the inferior angle. This one arises from the superior two-thirds of the dorsal surface of the lateral border of the scapula to the inferior facet of the greater tubercle of the humerus. So it's inferolateral to infraspinatus. So now we've done subscap, supra, infra, and then teres minor lies right behind infra on the next facet on the greater tubercle, right? Okay? And it does, it's two-thirds of the dorsal surface of the lateral border. So it makes up a little more. So here was infra, here is major, and minor runs right here. Okay? Infra, teres major, and teres minor runs right along this border right here. So we can see here where we've got teres minor. So teres major was right here. Teres minor runs here on this dorsolateral border onto that lesser tubercle, the last of the rotator cuff muscles. So it functions because it crosses the GH joint posteriorly from medial to lateral and therefore then wraps around to the greater tubercle. It is also a lateral rotator, similar to infraspinatus. So infra and this one are relatively similar in terms of it. It's thought to also adduct the arm because it's under the joint. And that thought to is right out of Mescalino, so he kind of quoted that. So I always thought it was an adductor, but he's saying thought to. With the arm at 90 degrees of abduction, the pull is horizontal, so this muscle also horizontal abducts at 90 degrees. Reverse action, when the arm is not moving, the scapula moves in upward rotation with this muscle. And that would make sense, right? Because it's down here at the bottom of the scapula running up to the humerus. If the humerus is fixed, the scapula is going to go like that, right? We can see it here. So you can see, you know, the two-finger trick here. There's infraspinatus there. And remember, when you palpated, you felt yourself kind of grow across teres minor, major, and then you popped into a groove, and then you came up onto infraspinatus, right? You're more likely we're going over major. If you wanted to go into minor, you got to get, as you can see here, you got to get up and over. So you've got major, fairly large muscle mass there, drop into the hole onto infraspinatus, and just inferolateral to infraspinatus, you'll find teres minor kind of stuck underneath over there. Okay. Innervation, axillary nerve, C5, C6. And the chicken wing is the stretch with strengthening, the same as infraspinatus. So no difference with strengthening. It'll get included in resisted external rotation. But the chicken stretch is kind of unique to infraspinatus. Okay. Trigger point tends to restrict medial rotation of the GH joint, causes pain when sleeping on the affected side, deep pain in the anterior shoulder, also deep pain which is localized. You can get altered sensation in the ring and little finger. So the patient may express that those fingers are kind of tingling a little bit. And then can be the cause of quadrilateral space syndrome, which is entrapment of the axillary nerve between teres minor and teres major. So we've got here, if I go all the way back to here, there's your quadrilateral space. So you have an artery and a nerve that runs through here. So obviously, if major and minor are tight, this quadrilateral space can get significantly smaller and impinge the nerve to some degree and results in distal symptoms. So here you go in terms of stabilization. Trapezius stabilizes scapula clavicle. Rhomboids major and minor stabilize scapula. Levator scapulae stabilizes scapula. Serratus anterior stabilizes scapula. Pec minor stabilizes scapula. Deltoid stabilizes GH joint and scapula. Corcobrachialis stabilizes GH joint scapula. Pec major, GH joint scapula. Lats, GH joint scapula. Major stabilizes GH joint and scapula. Basically, the rotator cuff muscles are the major stabilizers of the GH joint. That's one thing you really need to take away, that this whole joint relies on all of these muscles to stabilize it. So if you have an unstable shoulder, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, you got 10 muscles to consider strengthening that GH joint in all the variations of movement and responsibility for movement. Okay? All right. I think I've told you guys before. Sorry, excuse me, that's rude. There are textbooks that are 1,000 pages in depth just on the shoulder joint. That's how complicated it can be, and that's how many problems there are and how many experts have kind of written up on it. So let's continue working our way down. We've done the humerus, right? We had the head of the humerus, and we've got the trochlea and the what? Good. Capitulum and the supracondylar ridges and the epicondyles and so forth, right? So we remember all that. So now we're going to work our way down a little bit. Now, unfortunately, I do not have a radius. I have an ulna. I don't have a radius. Anybody bring their radius with them? Look at you guys. Awesome. Okay. Oh, okay, yeah. I just need a radius. That one. Awesome. Okay. So, in the forearm, we are looking at the ulna and the radius. The thing to remember always, we refer from the anatomical position. In the anatomical position, remember that the palms are faced forward, so they're supinated. So in the anatomical position, the radius is always lateral and the ulna is always medial. Okay? So I always said radium thumb. So I kind of always remembered the radius is lateral. Yeah, in the anatomical position, which is what we always refer to, the radius is always lateral and the ulna is always medial. Okay? Now we'll get to that later. All right. So there are two bones in the forearm. And the forearm's proper name anatomically is the antebrachium. So the upper arm, in the humeral area, this is known as the arm or the brachium. And the forearm is known as the antebrachium. We have the ulna and the radius. Anatomically, they do run parallel to each other. And when the arm is pronated, the radius crosses or lays over the ulna. So we're going to learn that because the ulna is fixed, remember that it's concave into the trochlea, like the trochlear notch, it can't move. It can only flex and extend. So that is the true elbow joint, which is a hinge joint, only flexion and extension. But as we know, the hand can pronate and supinate. Pronation and supination occurs with movement of the radius. So in the anatomical position, the radius runs parallel to the ulna. In pronation, the radius is crossed over top of the ulna, crossing over. So they sit like this in the anatomical position in supination, and then when it pronates, the radius does that. The ulna doesn't move. It is the radius that moves. Supination, pronation. So that means that there has to be some kind of configuration that results in this ability for the radius to flip over top of the ulna, and there is. So we talked about the trochlea and its relationship to the trochlear notch of the ulna. Well, the proximal part of the radius has a small head to it with a concavity that articulates with the convexity of the capitulum, and it spins in that relationship, which results in pronation. We'll get to that. Everybody understand? Okay. So, between the bones is an interosseous membrane. If we remember, that is called a... syndesmosis. Okay. And depending on the fibers, it either is highly movable or not so much, right? Remember, this has longer fibers in it, which allows for the movement to occur. Okay. Each bone has a head, and the head of the radius is proximal, and the head of the ulna is distal. I will repeat, the head of the radius is proximal, and the head of the ulna is distal. So we look here. See, here we've got, here is the head of the ulna, distal, and there is the head of the radius, proximal. Okay? So let's do the radius first. It is the lateral bone of the forearm, and as I said, the radius equals thumb. So I always used to say radium thumb. That's how I always remembered that it's on the lateral aspect. It is shorter than the ulna. The radius is shorter than the ulna. Now, the proximal radius has a head, which is a short cylindrical head, and the head is disc-shaped to articulate with the capitulum. So if I do the ball peen hammer like I did last week, right, we have the trochlea here, and then we have a circle here, which is the capitulum. Well, as we know, we'll get the dot on the wrong side of the T, but it doesn't matter. So we know that when we look at the ulna, remember we had this wrench-looking thing, which looks like a wrench. This is called the trochlear notch. So the trochlear notch surrounds the trochlea, yes? Okay, which means that the ulna is fixed and can only flex and extend at a hinge joint. But because of pronation supination, the head of the radius is this cup-like circular configuration that is concave. So it sits like this around the capitulum. This is flexion and extension. This relationship is rotation. So the head spins, concave, spins around the convex capitulum. So this is flexion extension at the locked in trochlear notch, and this is spin, which therefore gives us pronation supination. Does everybody understand that? Okay. So there is also a big ligament that surrounds this that holds that head into the capitulum. We'll get to that in a moment. Just distal to the head is a narrowing called the neck, right? So the neck is just distal to the head. It is narrow compared to the head. On the medial side of the neck, this little bump right here, on the medial side of the neck, it is called the tuberosity of the radius. So we've got this little bump here on the medial side, called the tuberosity of the radius. Guess what attaches here? Biceps brachii attaches here. Okay? So head that articulates, it's concave, articulates with the convex capitulum. Then we have the neck, and off the neck medially, we have the tuberosity of the radius, which is the attachment for biceps brachii. Okay? So far, so good? Here we go. We've got the head here, we've got the neck, and then we have the radial tuberosity, or the tuberosity of the radius. Again, is where we find biceps brachii attachment. Okay? The radius, the body or the shaft, increases in width from proximal to distal. So in the case of the radius, the head is small and the distal component is large. Head is small and it gets progressively larger as it heads distally. Okay, so it's convex laterally for the proximal three quarters, and then it flattens out in the last quarter. It gets flat. Anteriorly, there's a line that's continuous with the radial tuberosity called the anterior oblique line. It's not on here. It's not on this model. You won't see it, but we can see here. Here is the radial tuberosity that we see here. And then we've got, I can't remember if it's on here or not, or is it on this one? Let me see the oblique line. It kind of runs right here. No, really, I think I had a hard time finding a picture that showed it, but kind of running here. So, anteriorly is the line which is continuous to the radial tuberosity of the anterior oblique line. Medial to the shaft is a very sharp ridge for the interosseous membrane. So on the medial aspect of the radius, because remember the radius is on the lateral aspect of the forearm, there's a sharp ridge medially, which is where the interosseous membrane attaches. Okay? The lateral aspect is more rounded. So very sharp medially for the IOM, very rounded laterally in terms of the shaft. The distal radius, we have quite a widening here, right? So it started quite small proximally. It's gotten quite wide when we got distally. On the medial aspect is a notch for the ulnar articulation called the ulnar notch. So when we put the ulna on here, you see that notch right there? See the notch right there? Where my finger's rubbing, right? Right here. Okay, there, right here, that notch right there, right here. That is known as the ulnar notch. What fits in there? The ulna. Okay, the ulna fits in there. So we have that articulation occurring here. Now these don't fit perfectly because they're two different models, but you get the idea. Okay, so it fits in there. So in other words, when we have pronation supination, the radius is sliding along the distal ulna at the notch. Okay, everybody get that? Okay. Extending from the lateral aspect is the radial styloid process. You guys have palpated this yet? It's that bony bump right there. You know that bump right here on the lateral aspect? You can kind of feel a bump right there. That is the radial styloid process. Okay, that's what that is. Okay? On the dorsal or posterior surface is the dorsal tubercle. And the dorsal tubercle lies between the groove for the tendons of the forearm muscles. So it acts as a bit of a pulley when we learn the forearm muscles as they're traveling through here. This acts as a bit of a pulley for those forearm muscles. Understand, there are 14 muscles in this forearm. None of them are in the hand, but all of them and their tendons affect the fingers. So your ability to do this all comes from forearm and tendons running through into the fingers. Okay? Any questions? So we can see here we've got, here's the ulnar notch here for the ulna would fit in here. We've got our head, neck, our radial tuberosity, the oblique line kind of here. Here's the sharp ridge for the interosseous membrane, right? And we can see here's the styloid process right here and the ulnar notch on the other side over here, okay? Then there are some, there's the dorsal tubercle here, and it does separate tendons of forearm muscles as they travel through, okay? Whose radius is this? I'll keep it just for a minute. The ulna is the medial bone. We've already talked a little bit about it in its relationship to the trochlea of the distal humerus. So it's the longer of the two forearm bones. It is the medial of the two. And as I say, looks like a pipe wrench, doesn't it? Right? Looks just like a pipe wrench. It is the stabilizing bone of the forearm because this trochlear notch, fits in so well with the trochlea, so it helps stabilize the forearm. It's a very strong articulation. The proximal end is larger as compared to the distal end. So the radius, small proximal, large distal. The ulna, large proximal, small distal. It's the exact opposite to the radius. You want me to repeat that? Everybody's good with that? So we can see here we've got this wrench-like configuration, large proximally, small distally, okay? Proximally, there are two prominent projections. There is the olecranon posteriorly and the coronoid process anteriorly. So when we look at this, right, this is anterior and this is posterior. This is the olecranon process here, which is what you feel is your elbow, right, the elbow point, okay, sort of sitting like this. So this is the olecranon, and then anteriorly we have the coronoid process, which is here. So this is the olecranon process, and this is the coronoid process. All right? The anterior surface of the olecranon forms the trochlear notch with articulates with the trochlea of the humerus. So this is the olecranon process. Anteriorly, it forms the trochlear notch, which is where the trochlea... There it is. Fits in. Now, this is the wrong one. This one's better. This one fits in quite nicely. So you can see here's your olecranon. Anteriorly is the trochlear notch, which fits into the trochlea, which allows for that flexion and extension to occur. Right? Okay. On the lateral side of the coronoid process is the radial notch for the head of the radius. Well, that kind of makes sense, doesn't it? Because we had the radial notch, the ulnar notch on the distal radius for down here, correct? Well, we actually have a notch down here. We actually have a notch on the coronoid process for the head of the radius that fits in there. So we have an ulnar notch on the distal radius for the distal articulation, and we have a radial notch on the proximal ulna for articulation with the proximal head of the radius. Make sense? If it's like that, yes. It could be one of a various number of structures. You can get a fracture here. You can actually break off the olecranon. There's a number of different ways you can fracture the elbow joint. It's not a joint you want to fracture too often because it's a bit of a bugger to get mechanically back to perfect again, especially if they're very young, right? So you'll see that these individuals can't even get into full extension. They can only get kind of so far because of the way it's set up. So inferior to the coronoid process is the tuberous of the ulna, which is the distal attachment for brachialis muscle. So we have a tubercle. We have the tuberosity here of the radius, which is for long head biceps, or for biceps brachii, sorry. And then we have a tuberosity on the ulna, which is for the brachialis muscle. What does that mean to us? Because brachialis attaches on the fixed ulna, brachialis is only responsible for elbow flexion. But because biceps brachii attaches onto the tuberosity on the radius, it does have a secondary action of elbow flexion, but its primary action is supination. The major flexor, the prime mover of elbow flexion is brachialis, and the primary mover of supination is biceps brachii, not flexion of the elbow. So this is why when you're doing arm curls in the gym, you should finish with supination. That's why you're isolating biceps brachii, not just brachialis. So in the true sense of the word, arm curls are fine, right? But you must finish with supination. If you want to work brachialis and flexion, you take biceps out by doing reverse curls. So you curl this way, and that works brachialis and takes biceps out. The proximal ulna, I said, looks like a wrench, and of course this wrench grasps the trochlea of the humerus, which we've looked at a number of times now. And inferior to the radial notch is a prominent ridge called the supinator crest, which is the attachment for the supinator muscle. So we can see here is our olecranon in green, coronoid process is in red, the trochlear notch is in yellow, which where the trochlea of the distal humerus fits into, and then in blue is the radial notch, which of course is for the articulation of the proximal radius with the proximal ulna, which allows for that articulation to have pronation supination. And we can see it here. Here is your body here. Again, we have an interosseous membrane to attach here, and so forth. The body, the lateral edge is sharp for the attachment of the interosseous membrane. So remember, in the radius, the medial part is sharp for the IOM. In the ulna, it's the lateral surface that's sharp for the IOM, which kind of makes sense because of their orientation. It gets smaller as it travels distal. Remember, the ulna gets smaller the farther down it goes. Distally, there is a rounded head, and medially, it forms a conical-shaped styloid process. So the one that really sticks out in your wrist, the bone here, the styloid process that you can all see, that's the ulnar styloid process. So the radial styloid process is over here laterally, and the one that really sticks out, and some people really, really sticks out, and that is the ulnar styloid process. And you can kind of see just how kind of prominent it is here in the real one. It kind of sticks out pretty significantly. Okay, and some of you can probably look at your wrist and your bump's pretty significant. Right there, that's it. Right there. It's your ulnar styloid process. There's a convex area on the lateral surface, of course, for the ulnar notch to the radius. So we have an articulation between the two proximally, right? And we also have an articulation for the two distally. Now, the proximal articulation allows for spin to occur in a tight sense. And then the distal relationship allows the distal radius to slide along the distal ulna, which allows that crossing over of the radius over the ulna in pronation. Yes? No? Maybe? Okay. Okay. Wow, that was easy. So I believe our next slide is muscles of the arm, correct? Those muscles that affect the elbow, right? Isn't that what I've got? Here, elbow joint, I've got to do the radial ulnar joints first. And I believe that's the name of the slide, isn't it? Radial ulnar joints, yes. Okay, so I've alluded to them quite a bit. Oh, who was this, by the way? Who did I take this from? I can't remember. There you go. So I've talked about it briefly in terms of those relationships. So we need to talk about these radial ulnar joints.
This is the slide that we have this next. Are you skipping ahead?
Oh, is it the elbow joint I have next, not the radial ulnar joints? Oh, sorry. Okay. Does it matter? I don't think it matters. We're gonna do both anyway. So, the radial ulnar joints, again, I've alluded to, which allows for this pronation and supination to occur. So, the proximal radial ulnar joint is a pivot joint, which allows for the pronation supination. It is found within the joint capsule of the elbow, and it is the articulation of the radial head with the radial notch of the ulna. So we've got this articulation happening now because of that. All right, we have that what's called an annular ligament. So this head spins on the capitulum. So we have a round ligament that holds the ulna, holds the radial head, not only into the radial notch of the ulna, but it also completely surrounds the head, which allows it to spin within this ring of ligamentous tissue. So it is a U-shaped fibrous collar. It's attached to the anterior and posterior margins of the radial notch, and it holds the head of the radius in position. This ligament is lined with synovial membrane, so therefore it's part of the capsule of the elbow, and it continues into this sac called the saciform recess. So we can see here is the annular ligament that we see here that surrounds the radial head, holding the radius into the radial notch of the ulna. And it is lined with synovial fluid that we can see here. And then sticking out underneath the annular ligament is a little bit of synovial membrane here that will work a bit as a bursa when we're looking at the muscles of the elbow joint. Okay? So you can see here's the annular ligament from the ulna coming all the way around in a U shape to hold the head of the radius in there, which allows it to spin, which allows for pronation and supination to occur. Okay? Other ligamentous structures of the forearm, of course, is the interosseous membrane, which is this fiber sheet between the interosseous borders of the radius and the ulna. It does allow for this movement to occur, pronation, supination. We also have another ligament called the quadrate ligament. It's between the radial notch of the ulna and the medial surface of the neck of the radius. So we can see the quadrate one is, let's see if I've got a better one here, right here. Kind of sits right in here. So as I said, it is helping hold the ulna and the medial surface of the neck of the radius together. So there's your annular ligament there holding the head in for spin. And we have the quadrate ligament here. And what it's doing fundamentally is holding the two bones somewhat together, but it's checking that there isn't excessive rotation, that there's only just enough rotation for pronation and supination to occur and not get any farther than that. So it kind of holds it in place. The oblique cord is a fibrous cord that sits at right angles to the interosseous membrane. It's considered to be somewhat insignificant, and quite often we don't find it. So it's in here. I would say that if it's there, again, it's just controlling that flipping of the radius over the ulna in pronation and supination to some degree. Okay? Then you can see here where the biceps tendon kind of fits in the radial notch here for down the road. So here's your quadrate ligament. Again, helping hold that radial head in, and then we have the annular ligament that completely surrounds the radial head, which allows for this spin to occur between the two. Radial ulnar joint, so distal, is also pivot. This is the articulation with the head of the ulna with the ulnar notch of the distal radius. There's a disc here. This joint actually has a disc, and it is attached or located at the distal end of the ulna, which attaches at the medial edge of the ulnar notch of the radius, to the lateral side, the base of the styloid process of the ulna. So here is the disc here. Remember, the radius is a bit longer as compared to the ulna. So to make up the difference between the distal ulna and the bone, the carpal bones of the wrist, we have a small disc in here that kind of holds it in, and you can kind of see it here. It's been removed. So here's the distal ulna that's been removed. Here we can see the articular disc that the head of the ulna sits in. Right, because remember the radius goes over top or moves across the top of the distal ulna. So our disc is right here. So here's the proximal. Again, there's the joint capsule of the elbow with the annular ligament and the saccaform recess here, the quadrate ligament kind of underneath. And then distally we have this articulation between the distal radius and the radial notch on the distal ulna right here. And then we have a disc that sits between the distal ulna and the carpal bones of the wrist. Yes? Oh, my God. The functions, the disc is the main uniting structure of the distal radial ulnar joint. It separates the cavity of the distal radial ulnar joint from the cavity of the wrist joint, and it does provide articular services for the ulna and the carpal bones. Now, the capsule of this joint is a fibrous capsule, of course, because it's synovial, with a synovial membrane that lines it and also lines part of the proximal part of the disc itself. It can extend proximally as another saccoform recess of the distal radial ulnar joint, which, again, this saccoform recess is loose, which allows for the full range of the radius traveling around and over top of the ulna distally. So it's loose on purpose so that we get the full range. So we can see it here. Here is the joint capsule in the saccoform recess. We can see how these two fit together, and we need this looseness because the radius is going to spin around over top and back again, and this saccoform recess allows for that to move around and allows for that range of motion.
Which one's Tommy John?
That's up here.
Is that OCR, UCL?
I believe so. I believe it is. Movements, of course, pronation, with the palm turned posteriorly in the anatomical position or inferiorly when the elbow is flexed. Of course, supination, the palm is turned anteriorly in the anatomical position or superiorly when the elbow is flexed. Mainly, the radius rotates proximally with the annular ligament and distally moves around the head of the ulna. So it spins proximally at the head and it moves, spins around or travels around the ulna distally. Does So we can see it here. Here we've got, we can see it happening where we've got in the resting position here of supination, and then it spins here and travels over top of. So you can see what's happening here is that here is the distal radius here, here and here is it moves over top of and gets to the other side of the distal ulna. So it starts on this side and then travels around the distal ulna, which results in pronation. Okay. So we said the elbow joint's next, right? Is that what I called it, the elbow joint? Okay. All right. So the elbow joint. As we know, it's a hinge joint. It's the articulation between the trochlear notch of the proximal ulna and the trochlea of the distal humerus. So it's a hinge type of synovial joint. It's located 2 to 3 centimeters inferior to the epicondyles of the humerus. Remembering these flare outs here on either side, these are the epicondyles. We have the supracondylar ridges here, but then we have the epicondyles here. So it sits just below that. So we have the spool-shaped trochlea that articulates with the trochlear notch of the humerus, and the capitulum articulates with the head of the radius. So that's what you need to remember, right, is that the trochlea articulates with the trochlear notch of the proximal ulna, and we have the capitulum, which articulates with the proximal head of the radius. This results in the humeral ulnar joint and the humeral radial joint. The humeral ulnar joint is responsible for flexion and extension, and the humeral radial joint is responsible for pronation supination. Okay? These are the most congruent when the forearm is in a position midway between pronation and supination and flexed at 90 degrees. In other words, the most stable position of the elbow is this right here, in between pronation, supination, and flexion. The elbow is very, very strong at this point. Okay? So we can see it here. Here's your radial head with the capitulum, and here's your radial tuberosity. Sorry, your radial head here, and, of course, our ulnar here with the trochlear notch in the trochlea. Of course, it's a synovial joint, so, of course, it has a capsule. So the capsule, the fibrous capsule, surrounds the elbow joint at the margins of the lateral and medial ends of the articular surfaces of the capitulum and the trochlea, which will kind of make sense, right? It's what you're after. Anteriorly and posteriorly, it travels superiorly proximal to the coronoid and electron fossae. So we can see it coming all the way up into here. You can see it coming here as well. The synovial membrane lines the fibrous capsule, of course, and the intercapsular non-articular parts of the humerus. So it does cover a very large swath of the articulation and the bones that make up this elbow joint. Because it has to cover not only just the humeral ulnar joint, it also has to cover the humeral radial joint at the same time. They're not really separate. They're kind of all together. The capsule is weak both anteriorly and posteriorly, but is reinforced on each side by collateral ligaments. So because it's a hinge joint and we want flexion and extension to occur, but collaterally we don't want it, so we have very strong, powerful medial and collateral ligaments that help hold this joint stable and only allows for this pronation, supination, and flexion and extension to occur. Ligaments. The collateral ligaments, of course, are strong triangular bands that are medial and lateral thickenings of the fibrous layer of the joint capsule, so therefore they are intrinsic ligaments because they share fibers with the fibrous capsule. Now, the radial collateral ligament, so think of what we're talking here on the lateral aspect and the anatomical position, right? This is a fan-like ligament and it extends from the lateral epicondyle of the humerus and blends distally with the annular ligament of the radius. So here is our radial collateral ligament here, and you can see here is the annular, so they kind of blend together. So again, it's a lateral fan-like ligament. It runs from the lateral epicondyle of the humerus and blends with the annular. So here's your lateral epicondyle here of the humerus, and we can see how it blends in with the annular ligament and runs laterally outside here. Okay? And it's sort of fan-like, so a bit of an apex and then spreads out. It heads down out onto the radius. Of course, the annular ligament we've talked already about, it encircles the head of the radius within the radial notch of the ulna, and it forms the proximal radial ulnar joint that permits pronation and supination of the forearm. In other words, it allows for the radial head to spin within that annular ligament, holding it within its articulation to the capitulum and also the radial notch in the proximal ulna. So here we can see here quite nicely, here is your radial collateral ligaments. We can see this sort of fan-like configuration here, and we can see how it blends with the annular ligament here holding that radial head in. There's our capsule there. You can see how extensive it actually is within the elbow itself, and you can see it actually sticks out from under the annular ligament forming that sacciform recess, which again, that can act as a bursa and does allow for the movements. We can see here as well, here's your radial notch in the proximal ulna. See how it all fits in, and then we have this annular ligament that kind of wraps around and holds it in place. The ulnar collateral ligament, so now we're on the medial side, it is a triangular ligament that extends from the medial condyle of the humerus to the coronoid process and olecranon of the ulna. Remember, this is the coronoid process and this is the olecranon. So it covers a fairly large area. So we can see here on the medial side, we can see we've got the coronoid process here and the olecranon. So there's a transverse part here, a posterior part, and an anterior part. The medial is a pretty extensive ligament. So it consists of three bands, this ulnar collateral. Remember, it's the coronoid process and the olecranon, so it covers quite a bit approximately. There are three bands. There's the anterior cord-like band, which is the strongest. Then we have a posterior fan-like band, which is the weakest. And then we have the slender oblique band that deepens the socket for the trochlea. So this helps deepen the socket of the trochlea, which of course is going to articulate with the trochlea, the trochlear notch, deepen the trochlear notch to articulate with the trochlea. So it's very triangular. So anterior, very, very strong. Posterior, not so strong, and then the transverse providing depth within the articulation between the trochlear notch and the trochlea of the distal humerus. Okay, holding it all in. I believe Tommy John is this one. I believe it's this one that gets affected. Movements, of course, flexion and extension occur at the elbow joint. The fully extended ulna makes an angle of approximately 170 degrees within the long axis of the humerus. At full extension, the ulna angles away from the body, and this is called the carrying angle. So our ulna doesn't go straight down. If you look, it actually sticks out, right? So the carrying angle, of course, is wider in females than males, trying to clear the wider hips in the anatomical sense. So we actually have them. So this is called the carrying angle. So believe it or not, you can carry a couple of buckets and not be whacking into your knees. Right? It actually angles outwardly like this. Okay, and this is known as the carrying angle. It is more profound in females, about 10 degrees in males, 15 degrees in females. Again, it clears our hands away from our hips. So we can see here, we've got cubitus varus, which means it can get tight. Normal is here, and we can have cubitus valgus, which has the hands out too far. Generally, we don't see much. It's more important in the knees for valgus and varus as compared to the carrying angle of the arms. Okay, guess what we start next week? The easy ones are biceps and triceps and unconius, but then we start the forearm muscles. Those are the challenging ones. But they're fun. There, will Michelle be happy now? We're pretty